Good afternoon, everyone, and thanks again for attending today's Publishing Business Virtual Conference and Expo. I'm Matt Steinmetz, publisher of Book Business. Really hope you're enjoying our conference so far today. Certainly appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedules to join us. I'm pleased to welcome you to another great live session titled Discoverability versus DRM. Now, before we get started, I want to point out a couple of quick tips on how to make the most of today's live webinar. First, if you have any technical difficulties, you can troubleshoot by clicking on the Help widget at the bottom of the console. You can also use the Q&A box to submit your questions to today's panelists. Please make sure you've turned off your pop-up blockers. And lastly, if you leave the session at any time or would like to view it later, you can access the entire presentation in the PBV on-demand environment, which will open for 3 months beginning on Monday. So on behalf of Book Business, I'd like to welcome our moderator, Chris Keneally. He's the Director of Business Development and Author Relations for Copyright Clearance Center. He'll be steering our panel discussion. Thanks for being here, Chris, and at this point I'd like to turn things over to you.
Well, thank you indeed, Matt Steinmetz. It's a pleasure to join you and everyone on behalf of Copyright Clearance Center and myself. Look forward to today's program, Discoverability versus DRM. Balancing the requirements of IP protection and discoverability certainly is the great challenge of publishing today, particularly in book publishing. Digital discovery is, in fact, driving digital revenue, but digital discovery depends upon exposing content to the marketplace before the sale in order to drive awareness, interest, and then hopefully the monetization. We'll be talking about all of that, how that sort of works out in surprising ways with a great panel. We're going to first go to them individually for brief presentations that kind of set up the important questions. And then after that, we really do want to make this as interactive as possible. We invite your questions. Please use the Q&A box to get those in as quickly as you can, and we will get to as many of them as indeed we can. Part of this whole Publishing Business Virtual Conference includes not only these kind of live webinars, but a networking lounge that would allow you to continue the conversation after we're done. So I believe some of the panelists will be joining you there. We hope you'll be part of that. And so with that then, let's move on to our first speaker. I'll be introducing each of them individually. We'll be starting with Pete McCarthy. He's a multi-channel marketer whose interests include books, music, movies, and technology. He's the founder and principal consultant of McCarthy Digital, a consultancy to trade book publishers. He was previously vice president, director of marketing innovation for Random House. You can follow him on Twitter, at Peter McCarthy. Pete, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks, Chris.
Wonderful. Well, we should get to your slides here. We'll sort of draw those right up, and we'll turn it over to Pete McCarthy, and he'll sort of lay out some of the issues that we're going to be talking about throughout this session.
Thanks very much. Sorry, folks. Let me just get there. Okay, so when I was asked to participate in this panel, the first thing that occurred to me is I could produce about 250 slides on this topic. I mean, this stuff gets very granular very fast. The tack I decided would be more useful be to come at it from about 10,000 feet and really get at the heart of what we're dealing with here. So basically just what is discoverability? When we talk about it, what do we mean? And what we really mean is people finding things, in this case books. And what is DRM? DRM is any technology that basically locks that content in the way that the content provider wants it to be locked. So it's really about the usage of the content after purchase. So it has less to do with the finding of it than it does with the using of it once the consumer has actually chosen to make a purchase. Whether these two things are naturally pitted against each other, I think, is a wonderful question for this panel. I've been doing a lot of thinking of it myself, and I haven't come to a conclusion. I think sometimes they are. Sometimes they're not. Why do publishers, and for that matter, software providers, filmmakers, et cetera, care so much about this issue, and why is DRM such a big deal? I was actually startled by this statistic that copyright businesses account for 6.5% of the GDP. It's a big amount of money at stake, and you know it's no wonder that IP owners or IP stewards do concern themselves with issues like piracy. It's not a surprise. Whichever line of the DRM sort of battles one falls on, it's no surprise that it's a big deal. The legalities. This is where you know my mind kind of starts to get boggled. You know, we're still dealing with what's called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and that dates back to 1998, which is right around when I got my start on the internet, which is a little frightening. And in essence, you know, SOPA and PIPA. We all know the controversies surrounding those didn't get passed. The laws governing use and openness of content online, copyrighted content online, I should add, just haven't kept up with technology. And so what we're seeing now is an ecosystem that's developing kind of in disregard of any real legalities that make clear how things should work. And I think that's born out of the fact that this is unbelievably complex stuff. At least as it is now, I actually see DRM as a transitional technology. I don't think that we'll live in a DRM world. In fact, I don't think we'll live in an ownership world very soon. I think we'll live in an access world. With interoperable access to content as opposed to actual file ownership. I think that's going to go the way of the dodo, but that's just a personal opinion. In looking at it from a publisher's perspective, there's different types of DRM-free content out there right now. You know, there are forerunners who have decided to forego DRM. And I applaud them, actually, for their efforts. I think it's great for the consumer. From everything I gather from what they've written about their experiences, it's great for the publishers as well. Sort of first to go are publishers that fall on the right side, publishers I see as sort of information providers. And I see a natural reason for them having gone first. You know, they were very quickly finding themselves competing with free content on the web and trying to maintain DRM in that ecosystem just didn't make any sense. Kind of in the middle is a crossover like HBR, who just recently went DRM free. And I'm going to be really interested to see how they do. I think they're very innovative. They do a lot of direct selling. Which is very much linked to DRM, being able to go DRM-free. It's much easier to do if you rely more on your own direct sales than you do on, say, Amazon. Then you've got what I call narrative to the left, which is, you know, a science fiction and fantasy publisher like Tor, who has bravely gone DRM-free, though notably they still crawl the web looking for pirated editions of their books. So it's not as if I think they're owned by Macmillan. It's not as if Macmillan has just washed their hands of the issue. They're still keeping an eye on things. The last thing I wanted to talk about was the casual pirate. That's my casual pirate photo there. When I was working in major trade houses, this was always the sort of bête noir of piracy. Everybody assumes that a hardcore BitTorrent user was not a consumer of books, that their discoverability to purchase path was non-existent. It was a discoverability to pirate path. More to the concern of publishers was the casual pirate, the guy who does a Google search and finds a PDF of the latest Dan Brown book and downloads it. You know, I've seen very little compelling evidence that there's a ton of piracy in book publishing. It may have a lot to do with the demographic, the fact that it was DRM'd from the outset. But those are kind of the concerns and kind of framing it from a big picture perspective as I see it. And I look forward to an active Q&A because I do actually have some opinions. They're just not in the slides. So thank you.
Right. Well, Pete McCarthy, founder and principal consultant of McCarthy Digital, thank you so much. And I guess we know he's a casual pirate because he's not wearing a tie. Isn't that why? Pete McCarthy, we'll come back to you very shortly because you've raised some important issues that I know are going to come up throughout our program. We call discoverability versus DRM, part of the book track for Publishing Business Virtual Conference and Expo today. My name is Chris Keneally from Copyright Clearance Center, and one of the points Pete McCarthy brought up was the inability of copyright to keep up with technology, or at least the challenge that copyright and IP holders face in sort of bearing the brunt of innovation in today's world. We're going to move, though, to Pat Payton. Pat, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And, Pat, we should tell people that you are the Senior Director of Publishing Relations or Publisher Relations and Content Development for Belcher, the world's leading provider of bibliographic information and management solutions for publishers, booksellers, and libraries. You're responsible for communicating metadata requirements and best practices to publishers of all kinds. For those in the audience who are tweeting the conference, the hashtag for the conference is #PBV12. Pat Payton's Twitter handle is @DiscoverBelcher. And, you know, we certainly hope that you will sort of tweet your favorite comments from Pat today for her presentation. And with that, we'll turn things over to you, Pat.
Oh, great. Thanks, Chris. Since Belcher aids in distributing metadata to libraries, my slides focus on the discoverability from a library perspective. And I just want to take you through some stats that I found in researching for this panel. The majority of libraries are purchasing ebooks and making them available for patrons, and usage is growing. 76% of public libraries are offering access to ebooks, and another 39% are actually allowing users to check out the e-reader devices from the library instead of having to own their own device. And Library Journal has given us kind of a sneak preview into their book buying survey, and they have said that the circulation of ebooks in the library are growing by 102%, and they're going to release the rest of their stats shortly. So in people using public libraries to read ebooks, these readers are reading more than one book a week. And they're not only checking out books from the library, but they're purchasing them as well. And there's several stats on their purchases. So the extent of purchases is actually higher than I would have guessed. 32% of the users purchased the same book that they had previously borrowed from the library. 67% purchased a book by the same author that they had read from the library. 41% of users purchased their most recent book, even though they do use ebooks from the library. And 55% of ebook users actually prefer to buy their ebook as opposed to getting them from the libraries. So why do readers use the library and buy books too? I think it's because the library is offering a venue to discover books. It's easy to go to the library catalog. There's a lot of metadata in the library catalog, things that Belcher helps to supply, like cover images, tables of contents, book profiles of keywords, things like that. So once they're in the library catalog, there's also links. And I put a mapping up here of some of the links that you can go to. So in various online catalogs that I looked at, you could link out to a search engine, social networking sites, online retailers, book discovery services such as Books in Print or WorldCat, And the users then can in turn link to an author website, to an online retailer, or they may very well end up purchasing an ebook either through the online retailer, or there's a program called patron-driven access where the library puts a dollar amount on account, and the reader can actually say, oh, well, this ebook isn't available in the library, but I'd actually like to read it from the library, and they click the button, and the library actually purchases a copy. So the reader can read it, and the library owns the copy later. So I just hope this provides a little bit of background for our discussion from the discoverability viewpoint. And here's some reference links if you want to look at any of the research that I provided. And just as full disclosure, on the Library Journal patron profile data, Bowker does work with the Library Journal on that. So I look forward, again, to the discussion.
Well, indeed, so do I. And I should tell people again, Pat, that if you do have a question for Pat Payton, Senior Director of Publisher Relations and Content Development for Bowker, or for any of our panelists, please use the Q&A section to let us know what's on your mind, what you want to know from them. And we'll continue the discussion in just a moment. Just remind everybody that if you are tweeting the program, the hashtag is PBV12. And Pat, just very quickly, I found it fascinating that slide you showed regarding all the various links that are available through the library catalogs. That is discoverability on a single slide. I mean, that's what it's all about, driving people to the sales.
Exactly. That's my point in this whole argument. So we'll get to that later, right?
I look forward to that, indeed. Well, thank you again, Pat Payton. And we'll be joined now by our final panelist in the program, Brian O'Leary. Brian, welcome.
Thanks, Chris.
Brian is founder and principal of Magellan Media Consulting Partners, a management consulting firm that works with publishers seeking support in content operations, benchmarking, and financial analysis. A publishing veteran with 25 years of operational management and consulting experience, Brian is also adjunct professor for New York University's MS in Publishing program. His Twitter handle is at Brian O'Leary. And Brian, we've chatted a number of times in the past. It's great to be back with you for this program, and we'll turn it over to you.
Thanks. I've put together three different slides to kind of talk through issues. I didn't want to overlap too much with what Pete and Fisher were saying earlier. One of the things that I've really come to a conclusion on over the last 4 years, where, you know, starting in that 2008 when I began initially looking at O'Reilly titles for the impact of piracy on those books, is that DRM itself doesn't really stop piracy. And this goes back actually to Pete's observation about casual pirates. You know, when I first came into this, companies like Sony, which were relatively big in the e-reader business early on, were saying that DRM was the technology or the tool that allowed content creators and distributors to make money from book content. That's a direct quote. But what they mean is essentially that no one wanted to put their content in a digital platform for fear that it would get stolen. So DRM made it possible for publishers to feel comfortable with it. The reality is that true pirates, the ones that populate content on BitTorrent sites and others, don't worry about DRM. The most DRM that was used on books could be cracked in with commercially or freely available tools in a matter of seconds. It's really not the impediment. What it does do is essentially make it harder for people who would otherwise do something that a publisher might not want them to do, the casual pirates. Fundamentally, it's restricting what readers can do in case they turn into pirates, in case they do something that actually we can do with physical books. An example would be lending or forwarding or giving away a copy. Those are not possible generally on digital platforms, and that's a function largely of DRM. And so fundamentally, in this case, DRM is a business model decision. You know, you're making a decision about whether or not, as a publisher, it's worth putting DRM on to, in effect, make sure that everybody who doesn't have a copy of the book goes out and buys it if they want it. That doesn't necessarily cut down on discovery, and I'll come back to that in an additional slide, but I think it does cut down on the number of times when people might discover content because somebody recommended a book to them and handed it to them. We don't really have that mechanism in a digital environment, and we may not have it in the near future. I think fundamentally what that also means is that the value of DRM-restricted content is somewhat lower. I'm not sure that I'm iconoclastic on this anymore, but for two, 3 years ago, I kind of started asking whether the prices for e-books reflected not just decisions by retailers to price at a lower price point, but also whether the inability to do things with a digital book that you could do with a physical book was convincing people that it was worth buying, but not at the same price. So that was one of the things I think that there's not good data on it, but it's one of the things that I think we have to think about. Now, as this slide builds, I wanted to talk a little bit about 2 years ago, Richard Curtis, his literary agent, got into an extended set of conversations with an unnamed but self-declared true pirate who offered him a perspective on a variety of things in the business. And Richard Curtis had his own take on it, but these are actually direct lists from the interviews or the exchanges. And one of the things that's really important is at the very top, on the left, on the DRM restrictions, this particular pirate talks about DRM being a bad idea. It decreases sales, and as he says, it never stops pirates. At the bottom of the same column, he mentions that he actually prefers to buy O'Reilly e-books. They are not DRM. O'Reilly's been in this space for quite a long time without DRM, and other companies have joined it since then. But at that time, Bain, O'Reilly were two of a small number of publishers that were generally working without DRM, and this pirate actually respected them for that. On the business model side, and I think this is an important recommendation, the top thing is best hint. Don't obsess with piracy. Focus on selling, creating the value proposition that people want and need. And I think in that spirit, I totally agree with Pete that we're moving to much more of an access or a rental model in terms of content. And that's the reality that I think a focus on DRM and piracy can actually hurt you on. Now, with respect to discovery, earlier this year I got to work on behalf of the Book Industry Study Group to look at how metadata is being used in the overall supply chain. And, you know, a lot of the focus really was on the title-level metadata. One of the things that we took away from it is that there's a growing need for marketing data, and it's increasingly the case that it's going to be added during and both during and after publication. That's still at the level of a title, but it's increasingly important for having books get discovered. The thing that's not really being captured very well right now is what I would call conversational data, mentions, social media trends, what reader sites are doing, and that could become a growing opportunity for a lot of publishers. And then the final piece is essentially contextual data. You know, they're internal to the actual text. We're really not working on this at all right now. I think there's some work being done at Belker, by folks like Laura Dawson to explore what that might mean and how that might be facilitated and also promote both discovery and sales of either full or partial content. But that level of tagging, I think, is going to become increasingly important, particularly if we move to a more of an access model where we're comfortable putting content on the web and there's a lot more to be found with it. So with that, I'll turn it back to you, Chris.
Okay, well, Brian O'Leary from Magellan Media Partners, thank you for that. And I want to start the questions going here while we get questions lined up for our panelists from you, the audience. If you do have a question, please write it into us, and we will be happy to address as many of them as we can in the time we have remaining, about 20 minutes remaining. We're talking about discoverability versus DRM. We just heard from Brian O'Leary. We've also heard from Pat Payton from Belker and Pete McCarthy at McCarthy Digital, a consultancy to trade book publishers. We do want to hear from you, but before we get to questions from the audience, I want to ask a question I think each one of the panelists could address, but first to you, Brian. Your last slide there talks about the potential value in contextual data. Can you give us an example of what that really means?
Well, I think right now a lot of virtually all of the metadata that we assign is at the level of an entire work. So, you know, there are 3 dozen fields that are really critically important, and that's kind of how we describe a particular product. But there's a lot of content within, particularly long-form work like a book, that could be very useful but not necessarily telegraphed by the title-level metadata. So I think finding ways to use essentially XML-first or more agile approaches to tag and structure content, at the very least at the level of a chapter, but probably more often at the idea of an at the level of an idea, is critically important. So it's essentially internal tagging to make to surface aspects of a work that may not be fully available if you're only looking at title-level metadata.
Right. And Pat Payton, I'd like to bring you into that. At Belker, you're working on this challenge. How difficult a climb is that to kind of get down to that level of contextual data?
Well, for publishers, because of the way they've stored their data traditionally, it's not easily accessible. So they have to change the way they're storing and creating their e-books in order to have it tagged, in order to then identify those pieces and be able to interlink them across books or across topics or across authors, so that that metadata will lead that piece of the item, whether it be a chart, an illustration, a chapter, a paragraph, to be viewable in another book when a user is in the other book. So that's the magic of it. Once you've identified chapters or pieces of chapters, then you're more flexible in delivering the content to the user.
And Pete McCarthy, let me bring you into that conversation. Coming from the trade book side of things, the real challenge today is, if I can put it this way, it sounds a bit blunt, but replacing the bookseller. We've seen the demise of Borders, of course, most famously, but what's going to step in to help that discoverability that the bookseller made possible in the past? And do you think that the kind of contextual data that Brian and Pat just been talking about could lead to the sales of something other than just the full book itself?
That's a complicated question, but to the point of in-book context, I definitely think we'll see more of that, and I think it will drive sales of sort of chunked, if you will, chunked pieces of content from books. From a rights perspective, that gets extraordinarily complicated, especially with older works, but I think it's something that publishers are interested in doing. I think, you know, with each of these things, there's always this sort of return on investment calculation that gets done, you know. Yes, it's possible, but, you know, is it going to add enough value to the end product or service that we're going to be able to monetize that at enough of a rate to the consumer, you know, price point to make it worthwhile? So I think, you know, I think it's coming, but I don't have a time frame. In terms of replacing the demand, particularly that bricks and mortar stores drove, I think a number of things are going to happen on that front. Actually, they are happening today. I think placing books in contextual environments where they make sense, almost making bookstores sort of light versions of bookstores that can live within sites. A good example of this would be Random House's partnership with the political site Politico, where they power a bookstore for Politico. You know, featuring contextually relevant titles. Great way for discoverability, great idea. I think, you know, moving more to the future, I look at something like Spotify in the music world, which is all about access and, frankly, all about social, specifically Facebook, and what a wonderful discovery engine that is. You know, I'm in Facebook, and I can see what my friends are listening to, if they choose to allow me to. Now, some people wouldn't want that. You know, that kind of discoverability to me is sort of like word of – it's almost like automated word of mouth, if you will, which is kind of the marketer's gold. So I see things kind of heading in that direction where things are contextual – they're based on your network, your trusted network, the kinds of content you like, in sort of a ubiquitous layer of books as opposed to books being their own vertical, if that makes sense.
Indeed, it does. You know, I was so fond of that slide, Pat Payton, that I want to go right back to it very quickly because I think it addresses some of the things that Pete was just talking about. And the central role, actually it's not central in that drawing, but the significant role that the library catalog and the library access to e-books in the library is playing. And really in there, on one side is the online retailer, but in the middle is the social networking. What are your thoughts on how the library is really coming to stand in for the bookseller?
Well, I think that the library is an additional layer for the bookseller because both ways have always been discoverability for physical books. as bookstores have gone off and started with their own ebook stores, libraries, instead of selling ebooks, have added to their discovery layer so that you can find a path to other books. So both of them are getting an idea in front of the user. The user knows what a little bit about what they're looking for, so they're showing them other options. They're showing them recommendations. They're showing them what's on the shelf around what they came to the website for, and then allowing the user to browse visually and pick something else out that they want to read. So I think that they've always both done it in their own path, but I think that some of the developments in the library catalog are surprising because they're an independent third party. They're not trying to sell you the books from their store. They're trying to help you discover it through any avenue you want to discover it in. So they freely hook up with these other websites and social networking sites, and they don't have an interest in making money off of one of those chains. They just have an interest in helping people find the books they want to read.
All right. Well, Pat Payton, thanks for that. And now we do want to turn it over to the audience, and this is a program about discoverability versus DRM, as if they were in opposition. I know Pete McCarthy has some thoughts about whether or not they really are, but let's turn over to the audience here and a question about DRM and its place in different markets. And Brian O'Leary, you've done a lot of research on all this, and so I want to start this question with you, and then perhaps the others can join in. A question here from Holly. Do you think the DRM issues are different in different marketplaces? And Pete talked about some of this, but she says, I can see it not being a big deal in consumer and professional markets, meaning DRM might have less value. But in higher ed, she says, I think removing DRM would open the floodgates for sharing. College kids hate to pay for stuff, or at least maybe not that kind of stuff, Brian. So what do you know about that? Is there any research you could tell us about, or just your own sense of how the different kinds of markets and the different roles of DRM are shaping up today?
Sure. I think that the difference is not so much the market, but the price point. So it's not about college kids specifically not being willing to pay for stuff, but rather that the price point for a lot of the things that they would pay for is measured in hundreds of dollars, and certainly, you know, $75 to sometimes $200 for a particular text or access. And I think at that price, more effective DRM restrictions or some sort of digital rights management is useful, because the cost of doing that and the downside of the loss that you would have for if you weren't able to sell to the students would be significant. So I think, you know, when you're looking at $9 or cheaper ebooks, it's not really effective. What you're really doing with DRM is essentially locking people, letting a vendor lock people into a platform. So they have to buy from Amazon, or they have to buy from Barnes & Noble, or they can't use it on a given device, or at least on a given platform. And that's not necessarily something that's in publishers' interest. I think the earliest decision to go with AZW as an Amazon format handed the market to Amazon for a long period of time, and essentially gave them, because they had a lead on the device, gave them a 2-year head start on market development against any other retailer. But I think that one thing I'd say with respect to college in particular is that ultimately, DRM is not the solution you want to rely on. It's essentially, I look at it the same way Pete described it. It's a way station. It's what you can do right now. But you really have to be thinking about different business models, you know, providing access, including things like test components in a curriculum where you can only get at the test or the validation or the simulation by essentially having subscribed, so that if you're not doing those things, then you're essentially not in part of the overall class. I think that, you know, different business models is a more effective thing over time relative to DRM.
Pete McCarthy, can I bring you into that? You alluded to some of the different places for DRM and the kind of overlap there. And yet I think you have a sense that the ecosystem as we know it today in publishing has DRM in it. What would you say to just taking DRM out of the whole system?
I think it's a big bat to swing to try to take DRM out of the whole system. There are a lot of players, many of them very large and not publishers, so, you know, people like Amazon, like Apple, who in essence, are looking for a network effect. They want platforms, and they want purchasers of their devices to use their devices. I mean, that was Jeff Bezos' quote with the latest Kindle Fire was, we win when consumers use our devices. Well, best way to do that is to make it so that those e-books work on those devices and not other devices. So, for a publisher to, remove DRM, for the time being, it's been, I don't want to say smaller publishers, but it hasn't been one of the big six, let's put it that way, who's come out and said, we're going to remove DRM. I think that would, I don't want to use the word war, but I think a lot would need to happen, a lot of change would need to happen for that to actually ever be the case.
Well, there's a lot of change going on in publishing right now, Pete. So it's.
I don't disagree that at one point this will happen. I mean, I can't emphasize enough how much I see DRM as really a relic of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and just kind of, as Brian put it, publishers doing the best they could to protect intellectual property. And then let's not forget, publishers are under pressure from consumers. They're also under pressure from retailers. Don't forget the agent and author community. If you've authored a book, the idea that it could wind up on a BitTorrent site is not that attractive to you. No matter what the stats say, it's your work. Some authors, obviously, you get somebody like Cory Doctorow, he wants as broad a readership as possible. He's very savvy, and does believe in open access.
He's also tremendously prolific. I think that helps, Pete. He's got a lot out there.
Doesn't hurt at all. I just think we're a little ways away from it. I don't think it's not that it won't happen. It's just we're a ways away from it.
All right. Well, Pete McCarthy at McCarthy Digital, thanks for that. I do want to turn to a question now that's for Pat Payton from the audience here from John. And Pat, he points out that Belker is now providing an option for publishers to upload a full PDF manuscript when registering a title ISBN. Is that used in discoverability, John wants to know, and if so, how?
Yes, it's used for discoverability. What we do with the PDF is we index it so that we're looking for keywords and words phrases, and then we also store the contextual use of the keywords. So say the word China is used as a country instead of as dinnerware, we store that contextual use so that behind the scenes in our products that are library discoverability products, if somebody comes in searching for China, we will be able to show them that item is relevant. So this goes to Brian's point of some of the metadata is buried in the work itself and it's not pulled out. Besides identifying it yourself as a publisher at the chapter level, say with an ISBN, this indexing allows all the content, all the topics within that book to be found in a search engine. And it's our search engine, to be honest. But there's other indexing that a publisher can do. There's indexers that you can buy software if you're interested, and then you can identify those keywords yourself. And it's very powerful. So you could take, in a couple of minutes, extract 3,000 keywords and then have the contextual use of those keywords. And you can also have the relevance and the frequency of all those words within the book. So that's a project that we're working on, and it's free for publishers to participate, and they can contact me if they're interested.
Well, that's some up-to-date information on that. Thank you for that question, John. And I think as a final question here, we want to turn to a question from a librarian, it sounds like, Michelle. And she's asking, do you see any data in the increase in e-book lending from libraries because of the price of actual e-books? And the price of e-books is certainly another aspect of publishing that's under tremendous change given the recent settlement in the price-fixing case and just where all that's going to lead, nobody really knows. But what's the impact of pricing in regard to e-book lending in libraries, Pat? Did the surveys you've seen give you any ideas on that?
No, they didn't, but thank you for that idea, because I will definitely recommend that that's something that we start looking at in the surveys, because that is very intriguing to understand that behavior, and I'm sorry that we don't have stats on it yet.
All right, well, that's it's an honest answer, but we can come back perhaps on our next expo and give you some updates on all of that. I don't know, Brian O'Leary, if you have any thoughts. You were talking before about pricing in regards to the different marketplaces. Any thoughts on e-book pricing and how it might be driving the library side of things?
I haven't seen a study, and I think if one had been done, Pat would be the person to be aware of it. But I think that it's what we have seen, starting in the aftermath of the last this great recession, is that library use has gone up significantly, and Pat pointed to that in her presentation. And digital content is a piece of that. I think that what we do see libraries as is essentially a cost-effective opportunity for publishers who might not be able to sell as many books in certain economies. That suggests that there is a price sensitivity among the folks who would go to a library, whether it's because of the economy or the price of the actual e-book. But it's a critical part of the overall discovery. A presentation I did a year ago at Books and Browsers on the opportunity and abundance essentially made the argument that if we don't think about the ecosystem, the one that was laid out in the slide that you returned to, if we don't look at the ecosystem as a whole and think about what the impact is of people's ability to both discover and consume content, you run the risk that you're actually going to diminish the overall audience that you sell to in the future, and that would be a huge mistake. I think publishers have made some decisions with respect to whether or not they sell e-books to libraries or the price at which they sell e-books to libraries without really taking into account that whole ecosystem, and hopefully that situation will reverse and they'll begin to look more holistically at the overall discovery paradigm.
Pete McCarthy, any insights on that? How do trade book publishers look at library sales? I mean, it's always been a special concern for them long before digital.
Yeah. it's a very complicated issue for trade publishers. And to be honest with you, different ones view them very differently. You know, some view them as wonderful accounts. I'm not sure they're thinking too much of the discoverability. I think Pat's slide on how many purchases are made by people who actually check out the book would surprise some folks I know at trade houses. In terms of digital, I think there's always the concern that e-books in libraries turn into, you know, the sort of, the Napster, if you will, of e-books. You know, it's always kind of the concern. I don't think the majority of people see it that way, but I know, you know, it does come up as a concern. I personally don't happen to see it as a legitimate concern, but it has come up.
All right. Well, Pete McCarthy, I think we're going to take that then as our last question. Thank you for that. I'm going to thank our panelists one at a time here. Pete McCarthy is a founder and principal consultant of McCarthy Digital, a consultancy to trade book publishers. He was previously vice president, director of marketing innovation at Random House, and he can be followed on Twitter at Peter McCarthy. Peter, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Pat Payton, Senior Director of Publisher Relations and Content Development for Belker. You can follow her on Twitter at Discover Belker. Pat Payton, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
And finally, Brian O'Leary, founder and principal of Magellan Media Consulting Partners and adjunct professor for NYU's MS program in publishing. Twitter handle at Brian O'Leary. Brian, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Always good to talk with you.
Indeed. We appreciate everybody who's been on the line, those who asked questions, those who just followed along, and those who tweeted. The handle for the entire Publishing Business Virtual Conference and Expo is hashtag, I'm sorry, the hashtag rather, is pound PBV, PBV12. This has been a program that PBV calls Discoverability versus DRM. In the book track, there is a great deal more to come. If you have continuing if you want to continue the conversation that we've begun today, you can join some of our panelists and others in the conversation at the networking lounge. You can exchange your ideas there. Do that live. We hope you will take a moment to do that. And I believe with all of that, then, I want to conclude our program, Discoverability versus DRM. For Copyright Clearance Center for Publishing Business Expo, my name is Chris Keneally. Thanks so much for joining us.